Good morning and welcome back to Nachyomi. Today we're going to be learning Ezra Perek Dalad, the fourth chapter of the book of Ezra. And this chapter is about trouble from the neighbors. As we continue the book of Ezra, we'll notice that more and more it sounds so much like the times that we are living through. Let's jump straight in. Our Perek is a short one, and we're only going to be looking at 23 psukim in our perek. So let's start at the very beginning. The first five psukim describe opposition to the building. So what happens? We know right now the nation of Israel are building the Beis Hamikdash under the permission and the decree of Cyrus the Great. But nonetheless, Vayishmu Tzarei Yehuda uVinyamin. Those agitators of Yehuda and Binyamin heard that they returned and they're building the house, and they came forward to Zerubbabel and to the Rosh Ha'avos, and they say, Nivne imachem, we should build the temple with you. Kichachem nidroish lelokechem, because with you we should also build like you. V'loy anachnu zavchem, and to him we sacrifice. If you look in the actual pasuk, the word loy can be written with a lamed aleph, but is said with a lamed vav, which means they are saying to the people, we will sacrifice to him, but they're actually meaning that we will not sacrifice to him. So there's a duplicity in their very words. And Zerubbabel and Yeshua respond. Notice that the request was made to the political governor, Zerubbabel, but the response was both from the political governor and the religious leader, Yeshua the Kohen Gadol. And that's important to realize, is that matters of policy which relate to religion should be decided not just by the political leaders, but by the religious leadership as well. And they say, no, I'm sorry. Lo lachem v'lanu livnos beis le'elokeinu. It is not your job to build with us. It is us. Oh, this is our God. We're going to follow the orders of Koresh, Melech Pras, of Cyrus. And because of this, we're told that the Am Haaretz, the people of the land, are marpim. They weaken the hands of the builders. They are confusing them, and they are creating difficulties in building the Beis Hamikdash. And they hire lobbyists to stop their ability to be able to do this, and start sending lobbyists to Cyrus until the times of Malchus Daryavesh, the king of Persia. So let's stop here for a moment and appreciate a few points. First of all, who are these people exactly? Mitzvot David explains that these were people who are placed in Shomron, in the northern territory, as part of the Assyrian foreign policy. Just remember that when the Assyrians were globalizing and taking over the entire Middle East, their policy to avoid nationalistic rebellions against their empire was to shift people around. If you could shift people into a foreign territory, then they would not have the same nationalistic callings of trying to defend their homeland. So that's why they took the 10 tribes of the north of Israel and they sent them off to another place, to exiles all over. But they didn't just leave the land fallow. They brought in other exilees of their empire from other lands and settled them in Shomron. That's who these people are. And the Malbim goes on to explain, quoting Melachim, Beis Perek Yud Zayin, based on the explanation of the Gemara, that what is going on over here is that these people were set in the land of Israel, but they were pagans. So they started serving their deities. What inevitably happened was that the land of Israel could not tolerate such idol worship in the boundaries of Israel, and the lions of the territory, there were lions in the area of Shomron, this is the natural habitat, started eating these people as pagans, and they realized that if they weren't going to be monotheistic and serve God, they would be eaten. So they therefore complied, at least outwardly, to be monotheistic, to be able to survive in the land of Israel. At that time, the land of Israel was so much more sensitive to the real pagan worship and monotheism, and they were able to comply. However, the Malbim points out that there was a degree of question of doubt over their monotheism. Was it that they were simply doing that to avoid death, or was it that they actually believed in God? And that complexity, that doubt, arrives in the same question that they are raising over here, because they say, we want to build the Beis Hamikdash. Why were they rejected? So the Malbim explains that because in their hearts, they were actually Ovdim Beshituf. Shituf means to say that a convergence of different powers of polytheism, essentially. Meaning to say, they said, of course we'll serve God, but we'll also serve Baal. We'll also serve the other folks in the pantheon. And that doesn't work. Monotheism is exclusive by nature. It can only have one power, one God, and therefore they had to reject them. We go on in the Psukim. Psukim Vav to Chof Gimel now are the letter that these people, that Sarei Yehuda Obinyamin, send to the king. We're told actually now it actually shifts into Aramaic. We'll see why in just a moment. And it starts off as follows. Pasuk Vav is really the heading for the whole section. Uva Malchus Achashverosh, in the days of the king of Achashverosh, B'tchilas Malchus, at the beginning of his kingship, Kosu Sitna al Yoshvei Yehuda of Yerushalayim, wrote this letter about those who are dwelling in Yehuda, Judea, and Jerusalem. And then it goes on to describe this letter. The letter is actually to Artachshasta, and it is written as follows. We're told that it's written by Bishlam, Misradas, and Tavel, and all of their folks, and all their friends. They send a letter to Rachum, the commander, Shimshai, the scribe, who wrote the letter to Artachshasta. They send a letter, and they actually point out that they represent other folks around them as well, not just themselves. So they describe the Dinoye, those are the judges, Af Ras Techaye, Tar Paloya, Afros Soye, Arkove, Bavloe, Shushan Koe, Dahaye, and El Moya. So we're describing all these other groups that they have lobbied together, who are the natural inhabitants around here, who they say they are representing. So it's not just their own personal request. And they say, look, we all recognize that the people return to Jerusalem, which is under your command. But Jerusalem is a rebellious city. And if it succeeds in completing its building and building the walls, they will use it as fortification to stop paying taxes to you, O king of Persia. And they explain that if the king really wants to protect himself and not be harmed, he should cease the building. And they actually recommend that he does research and see that this city has always been a city of rebellion against its overlord, going back to the times of Babylon and Assyria. A few points to ponder before we go further. This is their letter that they write. How's this working? Who's Achashverosh? Who is Artachshasta? Why do we have two names over here? So Ibn Ezra says, no. Artachshasta is referring to Achashverosh. Artachshasta is the name given, it's the appellation given to a Persian king, like Pharaoh is the name for a Egyptian king. So Artachshasta is the name of a Persian king, but the actual specific king is Achashverosh. The Rav Sadia Gaon actually goes on so far as to say, based on Chazal, that this was written in the times of Vashti, and Shimshai, who is the scribe over here, is the son of Haman. So this is the precursor to the story of Purim, going with the timeline of Chazal over here, and this happens at the critical moment of the change of powers. And at this point in time, it was not the full 70 years, says Rav Sadia Gaon. This is really how Kodesh Baruch was doing, because it was not the right time for them to fully start building the Beis HaMikdash, which is why it was stopped. Why is there the word change to Aramaic? So the Malbim explains that you'll notice, if you look at the names, there's two sets of names of who's writing this letter. And he points out that a regular governor would not be able to simply reach the king. There was a system of superiority. There was an infrastructure of bureaucracy as to how to reach the emperor. So the way it would work is the following. The local agitators are the local leaders whose names are Bishlam, Misradas, and Tavel. Right, they now want to write this letter, so they write in their local language to their superiors who are in the area of Syria. Those superiors are Rechum, the commissioner, and Shimshai, the scribe, who translate the Babylonian or the Aramaic into Persian, so it's translated for the king to read. But that means to say that we're getting the original text of the letter, which is in fact in Aramaic. That's the way the Malbim understands it. Let's understand what happens. So the king now responds, Psukim Yud Zayin to Chof Dalet, which closes our perek. We're told that the king reaches out and he says to them, he reaches out to Rechum and Shimshai Safra, meaning to say they're going to translate it back into Babylonian, as understood by the Malbim. And he thanks these folks for their honesty and their help, and he acknowledges that in fact the city does have a long history of rebelliousness and contention. As a result, he declares that all building in the city will cease until further commands from him. He then warns them about being lax in this issue. Zehir in Hevu, Shalu Lemer Bad Aldana. Be very careful not to make any mistakes, he says. And at this point, the moment they receive this letter, we're told in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, they run to Yerushalayim Bechipazon in a great rush, and they stop the building forcefully. Be'edra v'chayil, with strength, they forcibly stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash, at which point the building remains in limbo until the second year of Daryavesh. Ad shnas tartein l'malchus de Daryavesh melech pros, Darius II, Darius the Persian. A few points to ponder. What does it mean that he says in Pasuk Chof Beis that they should be careful? Shimon Schwab explains that what he is essentially saying to them is, because I trust you, that you have my best interest at heart, I give you a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of carte blanche to notice any other plots against me, like the one you identified, because he thinks that this is really true. And therefore he gives them the flexibility and the license to stop other plots. You can imagine this is a big blow for the Jews living in Judea, because this means to say that these people who have nefarious agendas are essentially now allowed to be the policemen at will, based on the letter of the king. This is a terrible tragedy which is going on over here. How long did this last? How long did this gap start from the times of Daryavesh, from the stopping of this building until the rebuilding? So Chazal explained that the way it works is the following. The first king, of course, is Darius the Mede, who rules for less than a year. Then he's taken over by Cyrus the Great, who rules for 3 years. The beginning of his reign is when the permission is given, upon which the Ahasuerus takes over. Ahasuerus marries Vashti, who's the daughter of Belshazzar, giving him the royal line of Babylon through Nebuchadnezzar. That's his claim to fame, of course. And 14 years he rules. Darius II takes over. Darius the Persian takes over from him and becomes the king in the second year. It is when this occurs. It is interesting, therefore, if this is stopped towards the beginning of Ahasuerus's rule, we're talking about a 14-year gap of building, and in and amongst all of this, the sum total of time between the first decree to build and the second decree to continue building is an 18-year gap, which bridges the gap between the two sets of 70 years. 70 years from the rise of Babylon, which ended at the times of Daryavesh or Belshazzar, Daryavesh the Mede, and the second 18 years from the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, at the times of Tzidkiyahu, 70 years later is when the second year of Darius the Persian is, and the building starts again. So that's how it all fits together. However, we should be aware this is not so simple when it comes to actually the annals of Persian history. So Rashi already acknowledges this, that if you look in Yosefun, which is a summary of the book of Josephus, if you look in Josephus and Antiquities of the Jews, in the 11th book, and this is in the second chapter, paragraphs 1 and 2, he points out that in fact this whole episode that was happening with Artaxerxes is not actually happening with Ahasuerus, but it refers to Cambyses. Who's Cambyses? Cambyses was the son, or Cambyses II was the son of Cyrus the Great, which means, according to Persian history, which most historians take as fact, Cambyses II, who was the one who succeeded Cyrus, and he ruled for a number of years. And it is interesting that Cambyses was the one who received this letter, and he was the one who stopped the building. And therefore, according to this, it could be that the building really stopped for 9 years, according to Josephus. Accordingly, quoting Josephus, these works were hindered from going on till the second year of the reign of Darius for 9 years more. For Cambyses reigned 6 years, and within that time, he overthrew Egypt, and when he came back, he died at Damascus. So according to this, there's a very different order of kings, which would mean to say that Darius actually came after Cambyses, not necessarily after Ahasuerus, a very different perspective over here. And it is worthwhile noting that there is a general sugya which is worth looking at, is how to understand these two different timelines, the timeline that the Persians have in their annals, and the way Chazal frame it in Seder Olam, which is adopted by the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Tes, and what most of the Mepharshim adopt over here. This is a much larger discussion to be had, but worthwhile noting that they also changed the amount of time that this cessation happened, and also when the miracle of Purim happened as well. One thing which is worthwhile noticing is the message from contemporary times. Here we have a group of locals who are living in the land of Israel who claim to be the real indigenous inhabitants, whereas they really aren't. They come from all other lands who happen to be brought into the boiling pot of Samaria because of the Assyrian foreign policy. And now they think that they are the predecessors, even though the Jews actually came before, predated them. But they claim that they are the ones who should be here. They're the ones over the right to the land. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? They now also hire lobbyists to go to the superpower of the time to make make changes. And they succeed when there's a change of government. Because it depends who's in power and how the words are being put to the to that king who's in power. And it's important to realize that what we see happening time and time again in history, you know, whether it be, you know, France that was supplying Israel with arms in the 60s and then stopped supplying at the advent of the 1967 war, and America's, you know, flip-flop policy about Israel for many, many years, and looking at Russia's support initially for Israel and then its disappearance in support of Israel and supplying the enemies of the... One has to appreciate, as Rav Sadia Gaon says, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is ultimately in charge. And yes, we should do everything politically within our control. But it's also important to realize that history has shown us, Tanakh is teaching us, that ultimately what we're witnessing now has already happened beforehand. This should be comforting and strengthening for us. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.